Well, the prophet speaks a word that nobody wants to hear. So the first thing that crosses my mind, if someone's demeanor or someone's discourse or rant upsets me, then we're already at least opening the possibility that that person is an instrument for God speaking to us.
Andrew Scott Nicke is professor of religious studies at Manhattan College. He's been a devoted minister to people in prison for more than a half century. And we discuss today some of the lessons that ministry has taught him, problems he perceives with our system of criminal justice, and the blessings he's received from heeding Jesus' words to visit those who are sick and in prison. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Andrew, it's good to see you. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Matt.
So we met about a year ago at this academic conference about spiritual practices and social justice. And I was there, and I didn't know a lot of people there. I didn't know who you were, for example. I didn't know about your work. And we spoke briefly at a conference dinner the night before you spoke at the conference, and you were there at the dinner with your wife. And you both made this really good impression on me. I remember thinking about what kind and genuine people that you seem to be, which is always a breath of fresh air at an academic conference. I don't take these things for granted at academic conferences. And then the next day you spoke, and I got to say I was blown away by the subject of your talk, and especially by the consecrated life's work behind your talk. And if I may, just to set the table for our listeners, let me ask you a few biographical questions, okay? So here's the first one. I learned that you frequently visit people in prison. How frequently is that, and for how long have you been doing it?
Well, right now, Matt, for the last 12 years, I'm teaching courses every semester in at least three different penal facilities or jails in the New York City area, the Rikers Island Jail Complex, the Horizon Juvenile Detention Facility in the Bronx, and the Westchester County Jail, which is just north of the Bronx. So I've been teaching classes there at least in one and sometimes two every semester for the last 12 years. My interest in prison came about by an act of grace, as all things really do. I was a college student at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Not very motivated. Vietnam had me certainly concerned, and I took some actions with regard to my stance there. But for the most part, I never thought about our incarcerated sisters and brothers. And turned out that my math teacher was a priest who ended up being, or was, a chaplain at the juvenile detention facilities in Milwaukee. And I was playing music at the time, and he asked me if me and my bandmates would come and play for incarcerated girls. And I said, of course. And so my thought was, okay, maybe I'll meet a couple of bad girls here. But actually, it turned out it was an epiphany. It was a moment of absolute grace. I saw something there at 19 that burned into my soul. I don't even know why it did or what specific concrete instance. All I knew is I just kept going back to that facility and one other facility until I graduated. My first job after college was teaching in the inner city in South Central Los Angeles. And unbeknownst to me, the first thing I did was find the local penal facility. I went out and asked if I could visit and do anything. And that was 52 years ago.
Okay, wow. That is a long time to be doing this really very important but difficult work. And it's amazing that you've done this, Andrew. I mean, when I heard this at the conference last year, it kind of blew my mind. It really did. And at the conference, you situated your work with the prison population as growing out of your religious convictions, and you told the story of your conversion as a boy. Can you share that story too with us?
Well, I was a religious boy. My parents, God rest their souls, both willy-nilly were sent to Catholic schools. My mother, because she was an orphan and Polish. And so she went to an orphanage run by the Felician nuns in Detroit. And my father and his family were Polish immigrants, and he couldn't speak English. And so the only place he could go was the local Catholic parish in Buffalo, which is the area is heavily Polish. And so God rest him, even though my mom was a barmaid and my dad was a garbage man, they said, "You're going to go to a Catholic school." And again, you know, everybody says it's, you know, it's a good education, but all I know is that I was at 4 years old when the nuns started showing pictures of Jesus walking on the water and Moses parting the Red Sea. As they say, game over. That was it. That was it for me. That's all I wanted. I fell so in love with everything. And so the quick story is, I was a hyperactive child, and so I always ran around during lunch. And the school was, there was no playground. It was just an alley next to the school, and I would just run to try to get the energy out. And I ran to the front of the church, and the little message boards, as all churches have, you know, with the bake sale or the Sunday readings, the cross had fallen onto the ground. Why did that bother me, Matt? It was like seeing Christ on the ground. I don't know, I was maybe seven. I was so horrified. Time stopped. I didn't hear anything. I saw that cross and I said, "This cannot be. This cannot be." And so I picked it up. And of course, now I'm saying, "Well, now what am I going to do?" And so I'm walking. Can you imagine this? 207th, eight, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 year old kids. And here's crazy Andrew walking down the alley with the cross in his hand. And of course, you know, there's nothing kids like in an oddity that they can laugh at. And so now I'm screaming and laughing, and "You're going to get in trouble. You're crazy." And I'm walking faster. I'm panicking. I'm 7 years old. And I'm saying, "I can't put this damn cross down. Where am I going to put it?" And so I'm going too long. But, you know, all of a sudden the bell rang for us to line up, you know, as boys here and girls here. And they said, "The sister's going to get you. You're going to be in trouble, Andrew." And I'm carrying a cross. And the only thing that saved me was those desks. Maybe you had them when you were kids, you know, where you could lift up the top.
Yep.
And books, and I put the cross there. I said, "I'll worry about this after school." And then, God, such a wonderful story. The priest walked in, and I guess he had heard. And he and the nun are talking, and all of a sudden, sister goes, "Andrew, yes, sister. Do you have something you want to give us?" "Yeah, sister, I do." And gave him the cross. And so that's the story. And I've tried to figure out 67 years later, why? What does that mean? But I can't let the cross go. I think as Christians, maybe it was just that I Paul's line, "I want to know only one thing in Christ crucified." I still don't know what it means, but I know it meant something to me. And it's not like the sacred is here and the profane is there, but there was some way in which I felt like I was crucified to the world as Christ was. And I wanted to share in the sufferings, and I wanted to care for his people. Matt, I'm not a good human being. I am not a good human being. But one thing has always been true to us, holding on to that belief that I must bear my cross the same way my master did.
I think that's beautiful. I do. You spoke earlier, you talked about this, about you liken it to sort of falling in love, you know, and I think that anybody who has had the experience of love, especially a love that endures over time, and I not long ago had my 28th wedding anniversary, you know, and I still would say, you know, I love my wife. I don't, a lot like with the cross, I don't always understand what that love for my wife fully means. New things are revealed in it all the time, but I'm drawn, it's powerful, I'm there. And I think likening conversion to falling in love is actually really powerful, right? Because it's a way of saying, look, I don't always understand everything that this entails, but I do know that it calls to me, it bears on me, there's a responsibility it brings forth in me. and in religious conversion and you know this cross to which you felt so devoted. That's really, really powerful, Andrew. And it's clearly, you said 67 years. It's borne fruit in what you've done. I wonder if you can share one more story. You shared this at the conference, if you remember it, and it's a story, an experience you had, a deeply spiritual experience, at a time of really immense personal frustration. As I recall, you telling the story, it happened right before Christmas one year, and you went into a prison, and you for many reasons, you were just very frustrated. What happens to you happens after this. You had to catch a flight to get to, yes. Right, is that right? Can you share that story with us? Is that okay to share here?
Yeah, it is. I had an experience when I was a sophomore. I took a class in metaphysics, and I read about the death of God theologians, Hamilton and Altizer. It's just the same thing. I'm sure you know that your students can say this, and you maybe can remember. You know, certain things that you read, they just stay with you, and it wasn't a particularly good reading. But their point was: is if God is alive, God's going to be with them. If there is a God, seek the lowest, the meanest, the most desperate, and the most beaten down. If there's a God, you'll find God there. That did it for me. It finally gave me a destination as a 19 or 20 year old guy. And so anyway, I became an activist, and I wore myself out with activism. When I was in my 20s, I was going to organizing for a clergy and laity concern, an organization founded by Martin Luther King, was project coordinator there, Stop the War, U.S. out of El Salvador, you know, anything. And then I would do that, and then I would go and spend 6 hours at the Cook County Jail at night. I wore myself out. I had no inner life because my operating ideology was that a hopeful reading, but it didn't call forth anything in my inner. I reached a point where I was angry all the time. And so it was Christmas Eve and I wanted to spread comfort. I figured, what's the loneliest place in the world on Christmas Eve? It was a miserable rainy night in Chicago, but in the basement of the maximum security division of the Cook County Jail. And I went in there, Matt, intending to comfort. They didn't want to hear what I had to say. They wanted to call their moms and their girlfriends. It was one of the most shameful moments of my life. And I walked out of the jail under the pouring rain and realized I had no tenderness left inside of me. There wasn't a shred of kindness anymore. It was just misery. And all of a sudden, and I'm going to use, you know, if you don't mind, Satan is the accuser. And to that degree, Satan had enough of control of my life that I decided to take God for a tour on his miserable world on the night before his birth. And I was a sick man, Matt. I rolled down the window. You think of an invective that Satan would use against God, I used it. I said, you came for nothing, you wasted your time. Look at the garbage, look at the filth, look at the misery you wasted. It was honest to God, man. I mean, I know God loves me, but I realized I was out of control with the accusation. I barely made it home. I have no idea how I could even walk anymore because I was ready to literally fall apart. Certainly a nervous breakdown, if not worse. I somehow made it to the plane the next day to fly back to Buffalo. I got home and I went up to my room and I fell back and it wasn't my bed, man. I don't remember hitting the bed. I was just floating in some warm, beautiful, umbilical love. And I don't remember anything except telling God, I'm going to change. I'm going to find you. I can't lose you. And so glory be to God, that was 40 years ago. And I started what we call centering prayer. I started taking time every day to try to build that stamina, that self-control, that willpower, to practice God's presence everywhere, in every breath. Matt, I'm not miles from that. but at least I'm not as crazy and as angry as I used to be.
That's such a, I was so struck by that story. When I got back home to Salt Lake City, where I live, after that conference, I was talking about this story with people in my religious community up there in Salt Lake. And I was just so moved by that and what that had done for you and the manifestation, really, of that experience in the work that you've done in prisons for these decades, you know. And on that subject, I want to talk for a few minutes about your 2019 book. It's a book I really love. It's titled Conversion and the Rehabilitation of the Penal System, subtitled A Theological Rereading of Criminal Justice. And I take it this book is something of an opus, right? There's a lot of experience and an education you bring to bear in this book. Let me begin with the subtitle of the book, A Theological Rereading of Criminal Justice. Why the appeal there to theology? Why a theological rereading of criminal justice and not a political rereading or a social rereading or whatever it may be?
Well, the two answers. One is our moral language is steeped in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We have that the roots, the shafts are so deep, we don't even know in our secularized language how our laws, how our moral conversations, how the terms that we use, good and evil, whatever, abhorrent, despicable, lovable, redemptive, these are all saturated in religious language. But even more specifically, the prison itself is a religious institution. It was the Catholic practice of penance and monasticism that gave us our first experience of what we know of the prison. And by meaning by the prison is a place where you spend time, and you spend time for a purpose. And that purpose is a fundamental ontological belief in the absolute wonderful sacredness of every human being, and the fact that in every heart, the infant is lying in wait and begging for a chance to express her himself through us. And so it was a revolutionary idea. Before the church got involved with it, you either held people for ransom or you let them rot, like the Mamertine prison in Rome, which was next to the sewer, and they just let them die there and threw them into the sewer. Or you held people for detention, before you got punished. But this was a revolutionary idea. And so what part of my scholarly adventure has been to try to recapture what were people thinking of in the early centuries of the Christian era, in which they said, you don't gotta punish people. People punish themselves. What we have to do is create the conditions for them to find, it doesn't have to be in a cage, but you know what I mean? But the conditions for them to find the nature of their own misery. And it usually comes to some form of alienation, of being a non-participant in the human community. I think of all my sadness, and I think of all the ways in which I bring up my negative emotions towards others, and it's always because I'm excluded, or I feel excluded, or I feel I don't belong, or I feel I can't measure. So anyway, those are the two reasons why. To reread it is to go back, of course, into these more generic senses of religious precepts that do so much and infect so much of our conversation and our social policy, but especially to go back and uncover the history of the prison and say, is this an idea that needs to be resurrected? Or better yet, if we don't go back to that, then we continue to warehouse and butcher generation after generation of young black and brown men in this futile and evil demonstration that of justice, but is actually just a perversion of law and human dignity. So that's why I say a rereading, to bring us back to that idea.
And I thought this was it's a really compelling rereading, because the book blends, careful attentiveness to theological tradition and writers, with lots of awareness of social policy and philosophy and personal experience, yours and people you've encountered in these prisons. It's a really wonderful blend of these different discursive registers, and coming back to the theological part that was so important in all this, for what you want to say, for how to really change our understanding of these prisons. The great irony for me here is that these prisons are kind of born in our imagination as these monastic cells, right? People went to sort of find God. But today, I mean, in prison, that's just the opposite of how we tend to think about them. It's where we kind of put the discarded among us, right? So we can forget about them, get them out of the way, get them out of our lives and attention, and let them rot. It's the antithesis, really, of those moral and religious foundations.
Yes, and that's exactly what I say in the book. I can find no justification amongst the current dialogue of reasons why you take a human being and put him or her in this box, oftentimes for the rest of their lives. It's a cruel, cruel joke, and it's a perversion, as I said, of anything that smacks of justice or law. I don't even understand what the real logistical elements here, other than some kind of a projection of our own self-hatred and guilt onto a helpless population.
Right.
So that's why I think we have to rehabilitate the system, which in effect means tearing most of it down.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to get to that here in just a moment, because that's a very compelling point you make in this book. Let me ask you one question first. You know, many of those in prison who are there, you know, not just for, say, financial white-collar crime, but those who have done violent crime against other human beings, have caused a tremendous hurt and suffering and kind of left behind just deep wounds that in some cases take decades, if even then, to heal. What do you must encounter on occasion people who are the victims of violent crime. How do you make the case for the humane treatment of those who've done so much hurt to those who are left behind?
Well, one thing is for sure, and that is that we've moved beyond the vigilante system. We've moved beyond the vendetta. That was our past, certainly true in the Hebrew Bible, but really true well into the Middle Ages, until the first codified laws in the West came, first of all, with the canon law of the church, and then right after the various secular legal codes. Up until that time, it was vengeance, it was vendetta, and it was blood feud. So on that, I'm very, very critical of the legal system. But one thing the legal system does do is it takes vengeance out of our hands. Because so much retributive punishment is just strike back at other people who hurt us. It's a knee-jerk reaction to cause pain. So I expect victims of crime to want to cause pain. That's precisely why we don't have the vendetta anymore. Until the formation of both church and secular legal codes, beginning in the late 12th century, the vendetta or the blood feud was the way in which offenses against families were carried out. And one of the saving graces, and there aren't many, in my opinion, of our legal system, is that it takes the vendetta away from the angry and places it in the I would say generally the rational, discursive ritual of the courtroom. It's dispassionate. Everything is codified. There are rules of decorum and conduct. And I would say, at least in that sense, Matt, I'm glad of that. That's not to say we don't take victims seriously. Fact is, we take victims too seriously. You realize until 1991, victim impact statements were not allowed in courts, but they've become almost the cause du jour to cause harm and to bring harm by bringing the weeping survivors, the weeping mother, the bereft children, which stirs up a social rage far beyond often the pain that was done, and certainly with no sense of the history, the circumstances, the individual fallibilities, the errors in logic, the pain that leads people to do things to harm others. So I don't know if I really answered your question, Matt, but I think we do take victims seriously. We should take them seriously to a point, but not as an excuse to bring more harm on other human beings.
Okay. See, one of the things I find most compelling about your work, Andrew, is that it really brings attention to just how much pain that there is, not only that we feel, but that we inflict on other people, right? There's an impulse in some ways toward, you know, catharsis by inflicting pain, not just arriving at clarity or at forgiveness. And this, there's a cycle of violence in here, which is instinctive to us, which is deeply problematic from the standpoint of anybody who is a Christian or adheres to some other faith tradition. And that's why I want to come to here for the case that you make in the book for conversion, right? Conversion as the optimal aim of criminal justice, conversion and not retributive justice, not even just rehabilitation. And you write a number of compelling things about conversion in the book. I'll just cite one of the introduction here. You say, and I'm quoting you, "The moral framework that utilizes conversion as its basic metaphor is one that sees participation as the foundational truth rather than emotional remoteness, rational analysis, and objective judgment." Now, talking about conversion, is this religious conversion you have in mind, or is it a different model of conversion that you're trying
to? Well, it's a multifaceted approach. And why I write it, Matt, and I make the point in the book, the people who need to be most converted are the people who run the penal system. The people who need the conversion are not the people who are locked up, but the people who lock them up. And of course, you could extend that to who need conversion are in a sense not the innocent soldiers who are slaughtering one another, but the people who generate these slaughters, who legitimize them. So the whole idea of conversion is everybody needs to be converted. I use a wonderful theologian that I have used often, Bernard Lonergan, and he wrote a book called Method and Theology, and I use that as a template for this book, just as I used his book Insight as a template for the book a couple of years ago on the incarceration of the mentally ill. And he states, Matt, that there are three kinds of conversions, and the first two aren't religious at all. The first one's intellectual. And he says the greatest blunder in an intellectual or a rational framework is to think that knowing is like looking. And that's precisely what I do all the time. I make snap judgments about people all the time. And I am 100% wrong. And I use that as a way to justify, again, my own paltry existence. But an intellectual conversion is, you know. So let's just go back to your idea about the crime victim. I know that son of a bitch who killed me. And that's one of the reasons why for the last 24 semesters, I've made sure I brought students with me into the jails in New York, because I have not had one student. And I've probably taught maybe 35 classes now, so we're talking maybe 350 to 400 students who hasn't walked out saying, why do we do this to these people? And I say, you know why you feel that way? Because you can look at them in the face. And you can't look another human being in the face and think anything evil like that. That's Levinas, you know what I mean? Yeah. That ethics always boils down to the face. And so anyway, Matt, I just have this sense that this is what we need to do, and in seeing the face of the other makes it impossible to will harm upon them. But the intellectual conversion is always, I know about the Russians, you know, I know about this, whatever, the Zionists, I know about Hezbollah. You know nothing. And what you need to do is just keep listening and opening your heart, because an intellectual conversion says, I really don't know a thing. And I should just shut up and be attentive and respect all sources of knowledge. moral conversion. You don't got to be religious. You mentioned you're a married man, and I tell my students the most radical thing you can do these days is make a commitment and keep it. You know, I'm 28 years with a woman. As I say, my brother says, you can't throw them out, you can't kill them. I says, that's exactly right. Sometimes that's exactly how you feel, but you're there. And what I'm trying to say is everybody knows, I think, to say this, a moral conversion is less and less and less of you and more and more and more of the other. That's a conversion. And who doesn't need that conversion, Matt, right? So to me, the intellectual and the moral conversion would probably depopulate our prisons, because we know nothing about these 2.3 million people. That's why we keep them locked up, because if we looked them in the face and heard their story and heard the agony and the brutality that they've been through and the racism they've experienced, the people that they've lost, we couldn't hurt them anymore. And then finally, the third conversion is the religious conversion. But it's not a conversion necessarily to go in your church or synagogue. It's the move from the binary to the unitary point of view. The truly converted person judges no one. The truly converted person has kindness in her heart for everyone. And the truly converted person can see no distinction between anything and him or herself, that we are all one in this great, grand, beautifully blessed world.
It's such an important recognition, Andrew, of the dignity of people and all the ways that we unintentionally strip that dignity from people and how we treat each other. It could be something as simple as, you mentioned, these snap judgments that we all make of each other, right? We see somebody and think, oh, I know what they're doing. Someone cuts you off on the road when you're driving and you kind of make a moral judgment about somebody. Exactly. And certainly, I mean, when it goes to people who are incarcerated, that moral judgment, it kind of ratchets up a lot, right? We assume we know who they are. We assume we know what justice means. The questions I would have here, I mean, there's so many, there's not time for them, but questions like, how do you scale up a more merciful system? You know, how do you allow for the conversion of all of us while trying to sort of minimize the potential for harm to those that we incarcerate, to those who are the victims of violent crime? I mean, all these things are just questions about how it is we would do this. I mean, you've been giving this a lot of thought and a lot of writing in your book, and books, works plural, I should say here. You know, one of the things, I'm going to mention this right here, another book you've written even more recently, it's a 2022 book titled Injustice and Prophecy in the Age of Incarceration, subtitled The Politics of Sanity. And you make the point there that so many in our prison systems are mentally ill. And you make this really provocative connection to prophets, which is counterintuitive, right? But it's really provocative that there's something prophetic almost about the people who are imprisoned who are mentally ill. Can you explain that connection between the imprisoned and the prophetic?
Well, the prophet speaks a word that nobody wants to hear. So the first thing that crosses my mind, if someone's demeanor or someone's discourse or rant upsets me, then we're already at least opening the possibility that that person is an instrument for God speaking to us. The reason why I centered so much on the homeless, as we, you know, my city, you know, we have homeless everywhere. And for years I lived in Washington Heights, which is, because it's Heights, the subway has to burrow through the hills. And it's the only place in the winter where it's warm. And I used to go to college or school often at my school, college about 15 minutes away on the subway. And there were more homeless people in the tunnel and in the trains than there were commuters. And that's when it came to me. These people are frightening me. I don't mean frightening me like they're going to hit me. There was something about them that just made me want to hide. And I realized it was God. They don't have to say a word to me. This is the suffering Christ. Don't say you're brokenhearted on Good Friday, seeing how they tortured the body of our Lord. Our Lord's body is being tortured. And oftentimes it's precisely in the unkempt, the forgotten, the desperate, the poor, those who have no home, no friends, no one to speak for them. And it just came to me that they don't have to say a word. I call them involuntary prophets. And you know why I know this, man? Because we have swept them out of the streets of our cities and swept them not into asylums. There were 550,000 beds for the mentally ill in America 50 years ago, and now there's less than 50,000. Well, where do those 500,000 people go? I'll tell you exactly where they go. The largest mental health facility in America is the Los Angeles County Jail. Second largest mental health facility in America is the Cook County Jail in Chicago. The third largest mental health facility in America is the Rikers Island Jail Complex in New York City. And I said, why do these people bother us? Because they urinate on the tracks? Because they beg for your change? Are you kidding me? This is the voice of God. And it's thundering precisely in what they don't say. How they'll hold out a tin cup and say, can you help me, brother? And 99 out of 100 people, not only don't give the penny, it isn't that. They don't even look. Why? Because they can't bear to see the face of God. So that's the text for the book anyway.
Okay.
We're incarcerating the prophets, and God will not be stopped. Because we're generating prophets by the millions, as neoliberalism continues its stranglehold, not only in our national politics, but in international economics.
All right. Let me ask, time for a couple more questions. And this, I mean, I'm so moved by the work that you do with the most vulnerable among us, Andrew. And I know that the work you're doing is impactful on your students. As you say, you know, you take these students into these prisons and the students come out changed. I'm interested in the effects of your work on you and on how fighting this cause has shaped your spiritual life, for example. You know, the Gospel of Matthew records these famous words spoken by Jesus, and I'm quoting here from Matthew 25. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. You've lived that ministry, Andrew. And I guess my question for you is, have you experienced its effects on you as in any way sanctifying? Or to the contrary, has it instilled in you something of almost a tragic sensibility? I think the sense of hopeless fighting against a system that seems too big to change. And I guess I'm wondering then how you'd reconcile the seeming impossibility of the problem you're trying to solve on the one hand with, on the other, the faith that you hope to cultivate.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. And I know you feel it. I think any of us, people of faith, feel it. I'm not trying to change the system as such, and I'm not contradicting you, but I have no illusions that, you know, I'll die very soon and things will look a whole lot the way they looked 50 years ago. I'm a big fan of Kierkegaard in my later years. You know, Kierkegaard's point is, we're all depressed. It's just, what kind of depression do you want to choose? You know, you have the La La Land depression of people who absolutely refuse to deny anything negative about themselves, who plan their futures with this carefree nonchalance that I will continue to thrive and jet around the world and, you know, go to exotic places and do wonderful things until, well, I'll never die, but I'll just keep going. And he calls that the despair of possibility. And he says the other one is the despair of necessity. And those are people who just can't get their head out of the gutter because all they see is misery, fear, and pain. Well, I think, Matt, I think I'm closer to the despair of necessity than but then again, because Kierkegaard is absolutely right. When we face the impasse of the fact that we have unlimited imaginations and tragically fallible bodies, There's only one thing is to say it. In spite of all the hopelessness of all, there is one who cares for us through it all, and will see us through it all. Matt, I don't see a lot of hope right now. It doesn't matter. We talked about this. I think maybe we talked about this at the beginning. I can't recall, about some eschatological sense that we're all going, and we are. I mean, I'm a child of the resurrection. I know that Jesus is going to bring it all together in time, not in my time. I just want to be faithful. But Matt, I'm glad you said that. We were in class, and I asked the students, you know, I always do, like, yeah, what do you feel being here together? You know what I mean? And, oh, the most moving thing ever happened to me. I'm so happy I'm here. What do you feel? I said, I feel anger. I'm tired. The same beautiful young kids, man. Bright and eager, and looking at 40 years in prison at 18 years old. Every one of them, you know what I mean, have seen murder and brutality, and it's just, you know, I keep waiting for a white kid to show up, but you never see one. That goes back to our legal system again. And I just say, God, I'm so tired. I'm sorry, paternalistic old white man. I want to take all of them home. You can live with me. Stay with me. So that's, I guess, I hope, am I answering this, Matt? Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to tell you, I do. I have a sort of a groundswell of despair, just because I'm so tired of seeing these kids getting crushed and beaten and broken and humiliated and treated like they're vermin, not only by the society at large, even by the people who run the jails, certainly by the people who run the courtrooms. And it just wearies me to see Christ treated this way, but I can't lose faith. I know our Lord will bring a resurrection, and we'll all be, you know, Revelation 23, you know what I mean? It's all the tears will be wiped from our eyes.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and we will live gloriously together.
I love that passage. Yeah, you know, and I've got to say, Andrew, I even though, you know, you feel despair at what you observe from the system, and also you feel despair from what you observe in the eyes of the people that you visit, the fact that you can nevertheless summon the courage to go back and to go back and to go back and to look all that in the face and bring some measure of hope, compassion, and goodness to those who most need it, and in many cases, I'm sure, feel like they are least deserving of it, is, I think, just beautiful. Thank you so much, Andrew, for the work that you do. Thank you for talking with me today on the podcast. Blessings to you in your work, your ministry, your teaching, and I look forward to talking to you again, hopefully in person sometime soon.
I hope so, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.